From the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., this is Update One, the club's official podcast. It features newsworthy stories originating from the NPC facilities, as well as broader topics related to journalism, communications, press freedom, and transparency.
Welcome to another edition of the National Press Club Update One podcast. I'm podcast committee member Lincoln Smith, and with this conversation, we are joined by Mr. Gary Powers Jr., son of American pilot Gary Powers, who was shot down over the Soviet Union on May 1st, 1960, while piloting his Central Intelligence Agency U-2 spy plane. Welcome, Gary Powers.
Well, Link, thank you for having me on.
Your career includes a bachelor's degree in philosophy and a master's degree in U.S. history, also public administration. Tell us about your background.
Well, my background is very diverse. I grew up in Los Angeles, California. I worked my way through college doing construction. I thought I was going to be a real estate developer. But then my grandmother dies in Virginia in 1991. I come out to the East Coast. I meet my family in Virginia, in Southwest Virginia, where my dad was born and raised, and I discover that I don't know my family. So in July of 92, I pack up my bags. I move out to Virginia. I live with an aunt for a few months, get accepted into George Mason University, and I'm pursuing my master's degree in public administration. While there, I became the assistant registrar for the city of Fairfax. That led to another job as the president for the Vienna Chamber of Commerce. That job lasted between 2000 and 2005. During that time period, I helped to create the Tyson's Corner Chamber of Commerce. That was my background, my public administration career doing nonprofit management. Along the way, I started to do research on my dad, the U-2 incident, and what he had gone through. National archives, talking to retired CIA, FBI, NSA employees, trying to get the truth of what took place. As a result of that research, I ended up founding the Cold War Museum in 1996 to honor Cold War veterans, preserve Cold War history, and educate kids on the time period. That museum opened at Vint Hill in approximately 2011. I then took a back seat to their board. I'm on their advisory board still, but now I'm doing GaryPowers.com, which is writing, teaching, and lecturing about Cold War history. I found that while doing research on my father, I would go in to archives and talk to these groups, especially students in the local high schools here, sometimes AP history. I'd go in, I'd give a talk on the U-2 incident, they'd get blank stares. They didn't know anything about the Cold War. They didn't know anything about the U-2 incident. They thought often that the U-2 incident had something to do with the U-2 rock band. That, combined with the fact that, you know, Dad's in the history books, but there are hundreds of thousands of other men and women who fought, sacrificed, some of which who died during this conflict. They had not been recognized for their service to our country. So I thought it was very important to honor our Cold War veterans as well as educate future generations. And that was the concept for the creation of the Cold War Museum. At first, I thought it would take 3 years. Fundraise $3 million. Shouldn't be too hard to do. It took 15 years to get brick and mortar. And we were very lucky to get the location at Vint Hill, 45 miles west of Washington, D.C., an authentic Cold War historic site used by NSA, CIA, ASA, Army Security Agency, as a listening post. They had antenna fields pointed towards Washington, D.C. to pick up the embassy communications. They were able to receive international signals from around the world that they could then transcribe and translate to find out what our enemies were doing. So that base was closed in 1995 or the mid-90s, and we acquired it in 2011, one of the buildings on site.
Do you think the Cold War is over?
I'll give you an antidote. I do not. It is still going on. I have a KGB friend that has helped me to get into places in Moscow that I would otherwise not have been able to get into. She's been retired for many years. She and I hit it off. I consider her a friend. When I was first starting the Cold War Museum in 96, so probably about 98, I was calling her, emailing her, hey, can you help me? I'd like to get some artifacts from the KGB to put in the Cold War Museum to highlight their efforts during the Cold War. She rounded up their flagpole. About 2 or 3 months later, she comes back and says, Gary, I got a response. The response is, he will get no help from us. The Cold War is not over.
On that day in 1960, when your father was shot down, he was a 30-year-old CIA pilot expecting to make his way without incident all the way across the Soviet Union to a base in Norway. In your own words, can you tell us what happened?
Yes. And these are both in my own words and the words of my dad that I've read or listened to. So my father is trained to fly the U-2 at Area 51 in the Nevada desert in mid-1956. He's recruited by the CIA from the Air Force to fly these U-2 missions. He flies 27 successful missions between November of 56 and May 1st of 1960. As a result of his experience flying the U-2, being one of the pilots with the most number of hours in the plane, he's selected for the May 1st, 1960 mission. This mission will take off from Peshawar, Pakistan. It'll fly some 3,000 miles north, should land in Bodø, Norway. Should be about 9 hours to fly. This is the very first time that the CIA is trying this path that will go across the entire width of the Soviet Union. Other missions, previous missions, would go along the border. They'd go in, come back out. But this is the first time to fly across the entire width of the Soviet Union. My father wakes up very early on May 1st, goes through his briefing, gets into his pressure suit, gets pure oxygen pumped in for about an hour to breathe pure oxygen. That way, the nitrogen bubbles help to get out of the bloodstream. Pilots who fly at extreme altitudes can get something similar to the bends. So in order to prevent that, you need to have this oxygen in your system prior to a high flight. My father takes off at approximately 9 a.m., crosses over the Soviet's border at about 68,000 feet, flips on and off the camera switches that will take the photographic imagery of the ground below. He is 4 hours into his mission. He's at an altitude of 70,500 feet over the city of Sverdlovsk. There's a bright orange flash. Shockwave hits the plane. The shockwave that hits the plane pushes my dad back in his seat as it pushes the plane forward. Dad realizes something's gone wrong. The controls no longer respond. You can't fly a plane without a tail section. The near miss of a Soviet new and improved SA-2 missile, one of eight fired at the airplane, explodes near enough to the tail section to cause structural failure. As a result, the nose pitches forward, the wings snap off. Dad falls in this wreckage upside down, inverted spin from about 70,500 feet to 30,000 feet before bailing out of the airplane. He does not eject. He realizes that if he uses the ejection system, he will sever his legs on the way out. The U-2 cockpit is very small, very tight, very compact. In order to eject, you've got to be in a perfect position or you can lose a limb. Realizing this, my dad does the following. He starts to panic. He forces himself to maintain composure, take a deep breath, relax as everything's falling out around him. He realizes, oh, I don't have to use the ejection seat. I can crawl out. So immediately he undoes the canopy, which floats off into space, undoes his harness, and is sucked up halfway out of the U-2 cockpit, still connected by his air hose. Half in the cockpit, half out, spinning down towards the ground, could no longer reach the destruct button that's on the dashboard of the cockpit of the airplane. He's realizing he's getting closer and closer to the ground, breaks free of the air hose, falls free of the airplane, parachute opens automatically at 15,000 feet, he parachutes down to the ground. Once he's on the ground, he's apprehended and turned over to the KGB.
After the U-2 incident, Gary, it was reported the United States created a cover story indicating your father had been studying weather patterns for NASA, simply straying off course. And this cover story included presenting the media with a U-2 plane painted with phony NASA logos and serial numbers. When did the truth about what happened to your father appear in media reportage?
For the first 5 days after the May 1st shootdown, the Soviets said nothing. On May 5th, Khrushchev announces to the world that they shot down an American spy plane, shows a picture of the wreckage, but makes no reference as to the pilot's fate. As a result, the Eisenhower administration, thinking the pilot had died in the crash, or certainly Khrushchev would have paraded him around, they come up with a cover story with the help of the CIA that an unarmed weather research plane may have accidentally strayed across the border after the pilot had radioed trouble with his oxygen equipment. Once the cover story is in place, a few days go by. May 7th, May 9th, Khrushchev comes back up to center stage, very gleefully announces to the world, "Ah, comrade, not only do we have the plane, but we also have the pilot, Francis Gary Powers, who's quite alive and kicking and who's confessed as spying for the CIA." So we have about a 7 day week between May 1st, when Dad is shot down, May 5th, when the Soviets announce the shoot down, and then finally being revealed it's a CIA spy flight on May 7th to 9th of 1960.
Can you tell us more about where your dad was detained in the Soviet Union?
Sure. So Dad was taken to a local facility in Sverdlovsk. That afternoon, the KGB arrived. Two armed guards take him to Moscow's airport and then shuttle him over to Lubyanka prison. Lubyanka is the infamous KGB prison, part of and adjacent to the KGB headquarters in downtown Moscow. So this is where he finds himself his first night of captivity on May 1st of 60. For the next 3 months, my father is interrogated in Lubyanka prison. 10, 12, 16-hour days, bright spotlight, grueling questions, threats of death, but no physical torture. I was able to talk with a retired KGB officer some 25 years ago who wrote the questions that the interrogators asked my father. And he told me that the reason Dad was not physically tortured is that he was too high-profile a person. The world knew that the Soviets had captured Gary Powers. The Soviets wanted to show how nice they were, how humble they are, put their best foot forward to get the most propaganda value out of this incident, to use it to the maximum they can to further embarrass the United States.
What was going through your family? What was their thinking in 1960 when the U-2 incident happened?
My dad's first wife, Barbara, at the time, was aware that he was doing weather research missions. All of the wives would talk amongst themselves, and they kind of put two and two together as to what they were actually doing, but no one would really discuss it. When my father was shot down, my dad's first wife found out about it as she's being escorted, I want to say, through an airport, and she sees the headlines that Gary Powers shot down over Russia. She faints because of the stress and anxiety it has just caused. So she's going through a very troubled time for the next 2 years. His mom and dad and his sisters on the family farm in Southwest Virginia are very afraid of what's going to happen to their son. He's in the Soviet Union. We've got Khrushchev banging shoes and saying, "We'll bury you." We don't know what's going to happen. They think he's going to be executed for this espionage flight. Fortunately, he was not. So they're going through the family. My dad's father, Oliver, was trying to do from the very beginning anything he could to get his boy released. He wrote letters to Premier Khrushchev. He wrote letters to Soviet spy Rudolf Abel in prison in Georgia Federal Penitentiary in June of 1960. Abel answers his letter. And all of a sudden, Abel is basically saying, "I'm not the right person to talk to. You should talk to my wife in East Germany about the potential to do an exchange, a.k.a. the KGB, if you want to try to do an exchange between me and your son." Well, every letter that goes into Rudolf Abel's prison is monitored by the FBI. The FBI shows this correspondence to their friends at the CIA. two of their guys in suits show up to the city shoe store in Norton, Virginia. "Mr. Powers, please don't meddle in our affairs. You can make it worse for your son. We will take it from here." And sure enough, they contract with lawyer James Donovan. James Donovan then brokers the exchange between Soviet spy Rudolf Abel and my father. And that exchange takes place February 10th of 62, the Glenicker Bridge in Potsdam, Germany.
A British Broadcasting Corporation BBC story by Ian McDougall, dated 3 January 2016, describes your father in a Moscow court appearance as, quote, "a convincing and genuine person caught between forces far too big for him," end quote. Can you share your thoughts on this report?
Well, sure. Back in 2016, several things were being declassified finally after a 1998 declassification conference, and this report came out through the BBC. Dad was basically a pawn in this international game of cat and mouse. He was an Air Force fighter pilot recruited by the CIA to fly the U-2 spy plane. He was a pilot. That's all he ever wanted to do was to fly airplanes. So when he gets shot down, imprisoned, and then ultimately exchanged, it's an international incident. So he is in the middle of this. But again, he was a country boy. Raised in Southwest Virginia on a family farm. His dad was a coal miner. He was the first of his family to go to college. So he was pursuing this dream to be a pilot, which is all he ever wanted to do. So for him, when he's on trial in the Soviet Union, he's stage fright already. He doesn't like to talk in front of crowds. And here he is with spotlights and cameras and international press all around. He basically has to conduct his trial response on his own. The defense counsel that was appointed to him not once during the trial objected to any question asked of my father. In the Soviet Union, you are guilty until proven innocent, unlike here, where we are innocent until proven guilty. The switch of those two words makes all the difference in a democratic versus a communist society. So my father used his own wits, his own mental capacity, his own training to get through the interrogations as well as the trial so that he would not divulge everything he knew. He basically played dumb. "I'm a pilot. They pay me to fly the plane. They didn't teach us what was on the plane." So they believed that because they didn't teach their pilots what was on the plane. But the U-2 pilots knew every inch of that plane inside and out. If something went wrong, a system broke, they would have to work with the engineers to repair it, to make sure it was operational for the next flight. So Dad was able to use his own wit to get through the interrogations and the trial by and not allowing himself to reveal sensitive secret information.
You have served as a consultant for the Steven Spielberg movie Bridge of Spies, which was about the exchange of Russian spy Rudolf Abel and your father. Can you briefly highlight your work on Bridge of Spies?
First off, it was an honor and a privilege to work with Spielberg, Hanks, Austin Stoll, who portrayed my father, Mark Rylance, who ended up winning an Oscar for his performance of Rudolf Abel, the sound crew, the props crew, and all the staff that it takes to put these productions together. So it was a great experience to meet and talk and share stories with these individuals. It all came about in about 2014, June. I find out through rumors that Spielberg is going to do this movie that will portray my father. And my first thoughts, how do you get in touch with Steven Spielberg? I mean, you just can't pick up the phone. So I tried to reach out to some friends in Hollywood. I grew up in Los Angeles, but even those friends who were actors could not provide an introduction. I resort to Google. I type in his name. I type in his movies, up pop people he worked with, type in their names, find some of their email addresses. So I send out an unsolicited email to about five or six of his contemporaries, and I basically say the following. "Hello, I'm Gary Powers Jr. I'd like to talk to Mr. Spielberg about this movie that will portray my father. It's very important that we express the Powers family's concerns. If he bases the portrayal of Dad off the misinformation, the fake news of the time, they'll be painting him in a negative light. If they base it off the declassified files, that have come to surface over the last 50-plus years, they'll be painting him as a hero to our country. So for obvious reasons, wanted to reach out and try to establish contact. As a result of that email, I get a phone call from their producer, Mark Platt. Mark Platt is better known for his production of Wicked on Broadway, so very well regarded, very well respected within the industry. Mark and I talked for an hour. At the end of the conversation, Mr. Powers, thank you for reaching out to us. You're very knowledgeable on the Cold War, the U2 incident, your dad. How would you like to consult for the film? Yeah, that would be really nice. Thank you. So I get this contract and I end up being a consultant on the film. I get to go to several locations in New York City and Beale Air Force Base in California to be on set. They ask me questions. I give them answers. I bring photographs in of my family in the 50s that they can use in Photoshop, put their actors' heads on. I provide them with audio tapes of my father that he had recorded. That way they could listen to my dad in his own voice as to what he had gone through. And so it was just, again, an honor and a privilege to work with these individuals, and it's an experience that I will not forget anytime soon.
Can you briefly reflect on the media coverage of the U2 incident?
Oh, yes, the fake news of the time. In 1960, we're coming off the McCarthy era. So he just come up and said, we have 154 spies in every branch of government, and here's the documentation, and everybody's a little paranoid about where these Russian spies are in our country. From what I recall, McCarthy didn't actually have the list, but he wasn't wrong. So Cold War mentality. So we're trying to gain the strengths and weaknesses of our adversaries. One of the measures to do that is to do the U2 program, fly over, take pictures, find out how many bombers they have, how many MiGs they have, and find out how long it will take for our bombers to reach targets should we have to go to war. So this is all happening when the U2 program's taking place and Dad's flying these missions. Once Dad is shot down and it is revealed he's alive and well in captivity, and that President Eisenhower had just been caught lying to the American public, because Eisenhower said it was a weather research flight, and Khrushchev shows that Dad's alive and it was a CIA spy flight, Eisenhower's trying to save his reputation. He's trying to figure out how to best handle this going forward. And all the while, Dad's going through the interrogations, going through the imprisoned incarceration, and media people of all the major newspapers around the world and TV are wanting to get this story. What's going on? How was he shot down? Was he shot down? Their missiles can't go that high. If our missiles can't go that high, it had to be the pilot's fault. So my dad's reputation is tarnished while he is in prison. Articles are written saying he defected, he landed the plane intact, he spilled his guts and told the Soviets everything he knew, or that he hadn't followed orders. So all of these were mistruths, innuendos, some outright lies of the time. What I like to call armchair generals. Well, I would have done this. Oh, he should have done that. Well, they weren't there. Only my dad was there. And he did whatever he could do to protect the secrets he had and to get out alive. He didn't want to get the death sentence. So my father used his own ingenuity, his own mental capacities to get through this very difficult time for 3 months of solitary confinement, interrogations, and then the trial, followed by 18 months of imprisonment in Vladimir prison. During this time, again, articles are being written, newspaper headlines are saying that there was a flame out, there was sabotage, a Norwegian spy planted a bomb in the tail section, that it was a UFO encounter. I mean, there was just all these different theories on what happened, because at the time, it was easier to blame the pilot than to admit we were behind the Soviets in technology. Easier to blame the pilot than to further embarrass a U.S. president. So this is what this is why Dad's reputation was tarnished. But at the same time, he did everything he was supposed to do. When he gets back home, he's debriefed by the CIA. They clear him. He is put before a Senate Select Committee hearing. The senators, 2 hours of questions back and forth. They exonerate him. He's been cleared by the U.S. Senate. He's been cleared by the CIA. But he's not yet been cleared by the court of public opinion because of the negative press that was out there at the time.
In ensuing years, do you think the court of public opinion has indeed vindicated your dad?
Yes, it has. But it took 40 and 50 years respectively, and a little before that. In 1998, the U.S. Air Force and the CIA hosted a declassification conference at Fort Leslie J. McNair in Washington, D.C. I attended that conference. I helped set up an exhibit on the U-2 incident for the participants to look at. During the conference, two very important things were declassified. First, the altitude at which Dad was flying, 70,500 feet. There was no flameout, there was no descent, there was no sabotage. It was the near miss of a Soviet SA-2 missile, one of eight fired at the airplane, that brought it down. So that was finally declassified. The second thing, very important, is that the CIA, working hand in hand with the Air Force, could not be separated. For all intent and purposes, it was a military operation. In the 1950s, 56 to 60, when these U-2 missions were flying, it couldn't be military. If it was a military plane, a military pilot flying over a foreign hostile country, that would be an act of war. Eisenhower did not want to provoke World War III. He wanted to gather intelligence, which is why he handed it off to the CIA, a civilian agency. But now, 1998, declassification documents and conference, it's a military operation. Once that word military was declassified, that allowed the U.S. government to step up to the plate and honor Dad as a hero to our country. In May of 2000, he was awarded the POW Medal, and in June of 2012, he was awarded the Silver Star. So as a family, we were very honored, very humbled, very grateful to our nation for helping to set the record straight. It took 40 and 50 years respectively, but it goes to show it's never too late to set the record straight, and we're very glad they were able to do so. Now Dad's reputation is intact, and he's a hero to our country.
In closing, any projects in the works?
Yes. In addition to the books I currently have out, my first one was Letters from a Soviet Prison, Dad's correspondence to and from his family. Thought it was very important for the historical record to have his written words able to be read by students and scholars. My second book is Spy Pilot, came out in 2019, 35 years of research, 5 years to write it, the truth of what took place. I dispel all the fake news and the conspiracy theories and show the truth of what took place with my father. My third book came out in 2022, Enemy Territory. It's a graphic novel, so basically a glorified comic book for a younger audience. I'm teaching and want to teach kids about this Cold War time period. So my next three books that are coming out this year, I will have one more graphic novel on the Berlin airlift that will be coming out this month of April, just in time for the 75th anniversary conclusion, sometime in May and September of this year. I have another book coming out on Cold War Virginia, all of the Cold War and espionage sites in the Commonwealth, the Pentagon, the CIA headquarters, Camp Perry, Nike missile bases, things like that. And then my third book is going to be done through the National Park Service. As chairman of the Presidential Advisory Committee on the Cold War Theme Study, they have published our findings. It's only available online. So I'm taking this online book, open source, federal government, packaging it, and then we'll be publishing it so that people can see and get a hard copy of the results of the committee and what they did for about 15 years to identify these Cold War sites across the country.
Gary Powers, Jr., son of legendary American pilot Gary Powers, thank you for joining us on the National Press Club Update One podcast.
All right, Link, thank you very much for having me on.
You have been listening to Update One, the official podcast of the National Press Club, the world's leading professional organization for journalists and a vigorous advocate of press freedom worldwide. If you have any questions or comments about Update One, send an email to updateonepodcast@gmail.com.